I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Just mention the name CIA, and people's ears perk up. Since 9/11, what happens inside that agency is under more scrutiny, and at the same time, the Central Intelligence Agency is under more pressure to keep an eye on events around the world. Just how this happens and what form it takes is often classified, but recently former CIA Director Porter Goss sat down to talk about the agency and the business of intelligence, coming up on Intersection, part one of a two-part program with Porter Goss and the world of intelligence. My guest, Porter Goss, started his career in Army intelligence in the early 1960s and moved after a few years to the CIA, where Goss worked in Europe, Central America, and the Caribbean until 1970. In 1986, he was elected to Congress and served as the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence from 1997 until his nomination as Director of Central Intelligence, or DCI, in August 2004. Also while in Congress, Mr. Goss was co-chair of the Joint 9/11 Intelligence Inquiry. He was the last director of the CIA to act as the president's daily intelligence briefer. The role was taken over by the Director for National Intelligence. Porter Goss also served as CIA director until 2006. Before his career in Congress, Goss helped to incorporate the city of Sanibel in southwest Florida and in 1974 was elected its first mayor. In the mid to early 1980s, Goss also served on the Lee County Commission. He's now speaking about current challenges in global affairs with a lens of experience that few people have. Porter Goss, welcome to Intersection.
Mark, thank you much. It's a pleasure to be here.
The CIA is one of many intelligence agencies in the U.S. government, and there's, of course, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, and now the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. What do you see as the role of the CIA today among all those agencies and offices?
The CIA's got a very unique role. There are actually 16 different intelligence agencies identified under the Office of the Director of National Intelligence under our new reorganization. And they include the FBI and a whole bunch of things that you know about and hear about who do various specific functions. NSA does the technical stuff and so forth. And we have the people who do the rockets and the space programs and those elements. The CIA is particularly unique and important to us because they are the only people that are authorized to operate overseas in a clandestine way. They are truly the clandestine service. And it's true there is a military aspect to that that is brought in under the National Clandestine Service, which is housed in the CIA. But primarily, they are out there for our national intelligence need to find out what is going on a global basis in areas of interest to our decision makers. And in some cases, they are asked to take action on actionable intelligence. This would only be in a way that would be under a clandestine activity because the CIA is uniquely allowed to break laws in foreign countries. But agents and officers of the CIA may not break any American laws. Now, that suggests that there are some laws in America that allow CIA to break laws overseas, and that is correct. There are some laws that allow us to do that, and they are called findings, usually presidential findings. What they are is an assurance to the American people that the agency people and activities operating overseas are overseen by responsible people in this country, and there are no rogue activities going on by CIA overseas. So if things happen, go bump in the night or something somewhere overseas, and CIA is suspect, you will never hear an admission of it, or you should never hear admission, because part of a presidential finding is plausible deniability, that we will not admit that that was an American activity, even though everybody may speculate that it was. And you will not get an official confirmation that it was an American activity. That is what the clandestine service is about. But the great majority of it is actually collecting the information. And that means having networks of spies who will tell us things that we couldn't find otherwise. And, of course, we can find much material these days through all the technological advances that are there. So we're flooded with information. It's those nuggets of things that people don't want us to know that we work the hardest on a global basis, in the capitals and the power centers and the marketplaces of the world, to understand what's the best for the United States and to be able to influence things on behalf of freedom-loving people, but basically the forces of good as opposed to the forces of evil, to be quaint, on a global basis.
How much of that is just being able to glean intelligence from sources that are out in the open and obvious versus uniquely covert, finding out secrets?
Open source information market is a huge marketplace now. We admit we do cull all of the possible avenues of information. Problem there is trying to figure out what's real and what isn't. Who do you trust? Who do you not trust? There's so many blogs and things going on the internet trying to get to the source of who actually put that out and what their purpose and agenda was sometimes becomes more important than the substance of what you're reading. Quite often that substance can't be verified. But the interesting fact is, well, why did they put that out? Who's trying to get what done here? Who's trying to influence what? So this question of misinformation, disinformation, psychological warfare is part of what it used to be called, a very big piece today. But we have an ever larger stable of analysts culling through open source information, printed, spoken, broadcast, televised, whatever, on a global basis to keep up, because the world's gone global. And for us to constantly know what to be on the lookout for and to warn the president of something happening somewhere is very important. You know, people say, well, what do you mean? I said, well, it probably doesn't mean much to you about what's happening in Bahrain, but we have a Navy, we have a fleet headquarters over there. So, well, where's Bahrain? Well, it's here. And well, why is it important? Well, because they're the Straits of Hormuz. That has to do with oil shipping. Well, why is that important? That has to do with the price of gas. So this, it's all related. It's internetworked. In a way that is very important, and you need to be able to give the president all the facets of a piece of information and all the likely consequences of a piece of information as best you can divine them. So now we take open source information, we take lots of dots, we put them together, and we try and come up with all those dots seem to add up a picture that says this, and sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. It's a little bit like the weatherman. Sometimes he's right and sometimes he's wrong. We've been spectacularly right on some occasions and spectacularly wrong on some. The WMD in Iraq was probably the most spectacular one of being wrong that I saw in my time. But the little consolation I can get out of that is that every other intelligence agency in the world was following the same conventional wisdom we were. We truly thought that Saddam Hussein had capacity for at least chem bio weapons of mass destruction. And we knew he had the desire for nuclear weapons. We just didn't know whether he had a stockpile. We knew he had chemical weapons, and he did, and he had a way to deliver them. But we never found those big warehouses full of nuclear weapons with skull and crossbones painted on the side that I think grew to be the anticipation about why we were going to war in Iraq, which is not entirely true. But that wasn't the entire reason, of course. But the worry about Saddam Hussein having those capabilities and using them, in hindsight, what it shows to us that he miscalculated, Saddam miscalculated our intent, and we miscalculated his intent. We learned something, and he learned something. It was expensive for both of us. He got hung, and we spent a lot of blood and treasure.
What do you think was the effect on the CIA of that failure to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I think it was certainly a benchmark in the annals of the agency. I would rate it up there with the Bay of Pigs as not one of our better moments. There was certainly no malevolence or bad intent. George Tenet used to use the term to me when I was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, when I would ask him why he was so certain that there were weapons of mass destruction. He'd say, we have good sources, we have independent confirmation, we have a whole intelligence system blinking red. And I thought, what does that cliche mean? And he said, really what it means is that all of our sources and all of the analytic indicators point to the fact that there is hiding and concealment going on. There have been programs. We have the people involved in these programs. We have the testimony. We have the evidence. We found bits and pieces. We have separate individuals here and there who are telling us these things. And it's true, those are single source people, and they're very hard to verify. But it all adds up to this desire to have these weapons. He's had some in the past. We believe he's been able to expand those capabilities, and at the rate he's been able to do it, we therefore conclude, and the fact that the signatures of hiding things are out there for us to see. We see these signature activities of trucks moving in and moving out at the night and so forth. We're applying all the scrutiny we can. And that leads us to conclude that, with a certainty, that there are weapons of mass destruction available to him. No other intelligence ally or any service, as far as I know, friendly or enemy, quarreled with that conclusion. What we all missed, I think, was that Saddam Hussein lived in a very dangerous neighborhood, and he had to keep up the bluff for his neighbors that he was the strong man, because that was one of the pillars of his power. And that fact was a lie, that he actually didn't have all that. But he manipulated information in a way to make us think he did. So he was part of the program of deceiving us. It worked. And in the end, we bought a program, brought on to the evidence that we shouldn't have. And in the ultra end, he paid for it in a big way.
Well, you mentioned George Tenet there, who was your predecessor at the CIA. And George Tenet himself, an interesting figure. He served under the Clinton administration through George W. Bush's administration. He was there before 9/11 and after 9/11. I wonder, when you were the director of the CIA, you mentioned that blinking red moment. Did you have situations like that, and were you able to understand what George Tenet had been talking about, and how did you handle it?
Well, let me go back to George Tenet's service. All Americans owe him a lot of thanks and a lot of credit for doing a very, very hard job under very difficult circumstances. George took over the agency at a time when the agency had had several directors in recent years, and the agency was seriously underfunded. We did not have the capacity we needed on a global basis to do our job.
You mean things like languages or just human
assets?
Well,
I'm talking about case officers out in the field with networks of people in properly positioned next to decision makers to be able to give good heads up to the President of the United States. We just simply didn't have the capability to provide what was expected of us for our national security need. Now, part of that is that the intelligence community has been stripped down over the years a couple of times for a variety of reasons. Some of it goes way back to Watergate. Some of it then came years later after sort of a Valentine's Day massacre equivalent, when one of the new directors came in and fired 800 of the case officers because they felt there was too much clandestine service, and there are certain people in the political spectrum who felt intelligence was really an un-American thing and we needed to cut back on it. We never rebuilt out of the days of the Church Commission, which really neutered our clandestine service. And so the consequence of trying to build the agency back became subject to the political games in Washington.
Was it also because of being in the post-Cold War era that things were being toned down?
No, I don't think so. I think it was more political questions. And there is a divide in this country about the use of intelligence. The appropriateness of having a clandestine service still goes on. There are some people in the country who feel, you know, rubbing shoulders with bad people who do evil things is not what we do, and we shouldn't encourage them. Well, we don't encourage them, but if we let them run free, they're going to be unpleasant surprises. So we try and get next to them and find out what they're doing. Well, that inevitably means being down in the sewer with some people trying to learn what their next mischief is going to be. That process came up again in the 90s. There was a big expose put out. It was pretty much politically motivated. It had to do with Central America. The country was Guatemala. New York Times took off on a huge story about CIA's murdering Americans. It was a huge hype. It was not accurate, but it caused a problem. It had a political blowback in Washington, and people demanded that we clean out the agency. So in those days, it was John Deutsch was the director, and a lot of people were removed, and sort of an ultimatum went out that said, we don't want any human rights violators anywhere near any of our operations. Well, so you just knocked out all the drug people and all of the mischief makers in the world that we can't go out and get close to, meant that we had some serious gaps in our information. Deutsch got removed, and Tenet came in, and it was not an easy confirmation for him. He was not the first choice of the Clinton administration at that time. So when President Bush, 43, George Bush, came in, George had only been there a little while, and the one thing the agency needed was some continuum in leadership so it could continue to build its programs, hire more personnel, get those language capabilities out there that we still don't have enough of, and do the training and overseas mission building that had been neglected for so long. I won't say totally neglected, but certainly undernourished in a very bad way. So George came in and was dealt sort of a bad hand on trying to bring this agency up. And so when he said the lights were blinking, everything was flashing red, what capability he had was telling him there's a problem out here, something bad is going to happen, but the capability wasn't good enough to tell him when and where. And so we learned the hard way and the when and where, even though we already had had a bombing of the Trade Towers in 93. And if we'd listened to the blind shake, we would have understood it was going to happen again. So shame on us for that. We were very much asleep on the switch of that. George stayed on, and he took what he had rebuilt and used it after 9/11 and got some additional authorities from Congress to go forth and try and find out what was going on. And, of course, all of Congress rushed forward and said, oh, yes, we want to help every way we can. Do what you need to do to build your forces. And suddenly the money started to flow, and we got all this congressional support that we hadn't been able to find for 10 years for our intelligence service. Things happen quite often that way in Washington, and this was no different. George Tenet then did build back a good system as best he could get it done. It wasn't good enough to ferret out the lie that Saddam Hussein was putting out there about his nuclear weapons. We've learned a lesson from that. We are stronger today. We are better than they, I think, than missing those things today. But we still, just like the weatherman, every so often we can miss one.
You know, the CIA is spread across many different theaters in the world. There's, of course, the Middle East, particularly Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran. China's position towards the Pacific is rising, and the president recently oriented U.S. military towards a more Pacific-facing outlook. U.S. Marines getting more involved, practicing in Australia. And also Russia pushing for a military buildup with Vladimir Putin. Where do you see as the most important place for the CIA to be focusing right now, and what is that biggest challenge?
The answer is everywhere. We are a global organization at CIA, and we have to have the resources to do the job. We do, I think, a very good job of trying to understand the problem. We don't have enough capability to deal with everything at the same time. It's just not a fact at this point that we have that capability. We're much better than we were, and we need to be better, and we need to commit resources to do it, because the kind of things you're talking about are unconventional warfare. We're not talking about tanks meeting on the plains of Europe anymore, or fleets and armadas shooting each other up in the Straits of Gibraltar.
You're saying the bipolar Cold War world is gone.
That game plan, that military plan, goes back on the shelf. Now we have unconventional warfare. And unconventional warfare is fought a lot of ways, but one of the things we use is SEALs, Navy SEALs, and the Special Forces type of people. And they are basically completely dependent on timely intelligence so that they can be flexible and agile to deal with the kinds of enemy activities that we find out about usually late in the day but have to deal with immediately. We are getting very much better at developing capabilities that can come in and touch on the psychological warfare challenges that are presented to us. You ask me which are the hottest at the moment. It depends what moment you ask that. I would say you can't take your eye off the ball anywhere. But right now, I'm most worried about nuclear proliferation in the hands of people who are not entirely sane, people who would vaporize themselves for either some kind of a radical ideological belief or because of some ingrained hate that is paramount in their life as opposed to any rational thought about survival. Those are the things that give you nightmares. They're very hard to predict, and they're very hard to know unless you have your ear literally to the ground everywhere. So the less nuclear and weapon and chemical capability that has mass destruction aspects to it that's out there, obviously the safer you are. So the more proliferation of that type of thing, the less safe you are, because even though the material is out there, it's benign until somebody misuses it. It's knowing who's going to misuse it, which is the trick. And finding those people and neutralizing them is really what the actionable intelligence needs to be. And that quite often takes more than just the clandestine service. It takes a marriage between the clandestine service and the United States military to deal with those issues. You saw that with Osama bin Laden. That is not a new thing that happened. That has been a mechanic that we had worked out over the years because we saw the need and we prepared for it. It's a wonderful success story. The part of that story that is unusual about Osama bin Laden is that the president of the United States got up and said, "We did it." He wasn't supposed to do that. That was supposed to just be bump in the night. Something bad happened. Oh, my gosh, Osama bin Laden is dead. We are not supposed to admit that we were over there doing that. You saw what a problem it's caused in Pakistan. It, frankly, is almost like an act of war to send in a war machine to another country that you're not at war at, that with soldiers with American patches or identifiable as American. So, of course, they didn't go in as identifiable as American. They went in with plausible denial. And that program would have been just as wonderful for the United States, would have worked just as well if we had never said we did it. The fact that Osama bin Laden is dead is what's important. It's actually better in a way if you say, we don't know how it happened, because the other Osama bin Ladens out there are going to worry a lot more. Now they know about our MO, about how we did that. It's a shame we gave that away. We didn't have to do it. The reason we did it was political. It had nothing to do with national security. It was strictly political. Now, those are the kinds of problems you run into in bringing the politics of leadership in line with the capabilities that you have of fighting an unconventional war. When many people think that unconventional war is a violation of human rights. Well, I suppose war might be a violation of human rights, but there are protocols involved. So we're now trying to figure out what are the protocols for unconventional war. Is this a criminal matter or is this an enemy combat?
Does neutralize always mean taking somebody out, killing them?
Not at all. My view on Osama bin Laden is I would much rather have him in Guantanamo, which is, frankly, a state-of-the-art detention facility that is very humanitarian. And all this baloney about how what a terrible place it is nonsense. Anybody who's been down there and seen it is better than many of our detention centers where we keep American citizens.
And you've been there?
Oh, yeah, of course. And several times for several reasons over the years. Guantanamo is a wonderful asset for our country. It's something that we had to have as a place to put unconventional enemy combatants. And this was, given all the complexities of law, the best way to solve the problem. It wasn't the best solution, but it was the least bad of the solutions available.
My guest is Porter Goss. He was director of the Central Intelligence Agency from 2004 to 2006. You mentioned your biggest concern is the proliferation of nuclear material. Does that mean you're concerned about North Korea and China as well with this new orientation towards the Pacific and Asia that the president's been talking about?
I think the orientation to the Pacific and in Asia has is something that was actually started back in, I know for a fact, in the Bush administration. It was something we were very much compelled about. It got delayed because of events in Pakistan and Iraq. It's not the proliferation of nuclear material. That's a bad thing. In itself, and we should stop that. And there have been a lot of proliferators, and we try and stop them in their tracks. North Korea, AQ Khan network, Pakistanis, the hero of Pakistan, the father of Pakistan's nuclear weapon. He's a big hero in his country, but he's frankly an international criminal as a proliferator of nuclear weapons. Gaddafi got his stuff from him and so forth. So you take a look. It's my greatest worry is not the proliferation. That's bad. My greatest worry is that being in the hands of a crazy person who would use it and has no concept of self-preservation, who will vaporize himself and others for some bizarre ideological absurdity that makes no sense to any of us or to rational people, but does make sense to them, and they can do a ton of damage.
That's a different kind of intelligence, it sounds like you're talking about, than what we romanticize in the Cold War. As what were military motivations from two nations with large armies and navies and that sort of thing.
This is not about empirical hegemony at all. We're not even talking nation states here. We're talking about radical ideologies competing, cultural clashes between for centuries that have been going on about ways of life, how to organize society, what God to pray to, all of these types of aspects that are part of the human condition, which should be resolved amicably. And, you know, in a coordinated, peaceful fashion, and except for the mischief makers, could be. But the mischief makers are serious. They're there. You have to recognize them. If even 1% of the total Muslim population of the world were radical fundamentalists, that would give us more than 1 million radical fundamentalists right out there right now who have vowed to kill us just because we're Americans. That's sort of a frightening thought, and one that most Americans just frankly don't think about very often.
Well, that is a frightening thought, but can you neutralize that at all by thinking that's a very small minority?
You could say it's a very small minority, but if a very small minority is a larger number than all the standing armies of the world, then it's not insignificant. And that's the kind of problem. So you don't want to play the numbers game, because actually, if you look at 9/11, look what a few people could do. I mean, if you want a comparison between conventional warfare and unconventional today, think of the mighty USS Navy warship Cole, the USS Cole.
A destroyer that was attacked by a small Zodiac.
Yes, and what we have is a rubber dinghy taking that out of action and killing U.S. Navy sailors on that.
In Yemen.
In Yemen, yes, absolutely. And you take a look at that act and you say, okay, it's quite clear that if we're going to match armadas against each other or tanks against each other, we're in the wrong business, because they've got more rubber dinghies than we do Aegis-class destroyers. And an Aegis-class destroyer is of absolutely no use. It's a target. It's not a weapon. It becomes a target. And it's a liability. So how do you fight this unconventional warfare? It's a very different way.
That's part one of our conversation with former CIA Director Porter Goss. In part two, which airs Saturday morning at 7:30, Goss talks about following North Korea and events in Africa, his time as a journalist in South Florida, and his favorite spy movie. That's Saturday morning at 7:30 on Intersection. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to sign up for our weekly podcast and hear previous episodes. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.